the emptiness of the I. Identifying the object of negation. Although we grasp at an inherently existent I all the time, even during sleep, it is not easy to identify how it appears to our mind. To identify it clearly, we must begin by allowing it to manifest strongly, by contemplating situations in which we have an exaggerated sense of I, such as when we are embarrassed, ashamed, afraid, or indignant. We recall or imagine such a situation, and then, without any comment or analysis, try to attain a clear mental image of how the I naturally appears at such times. We have to be patient at this stage, because it may take many sessions before we attain a clear image. Eventually, we shall see that the I appears to be completely solid and real, existing from its own side, without depending upon the body or the mind. This vividly appearing I is the inherently existent I that we cherish so strongly. It is the I that we defend when we are criticized, and that we are so proud of when we are praised. Once we have an image of how the I appears in these extreme circumstances, we should try to identify how it appears normally in less extreme situations. For example, we can observe the I that is presently listening to this book and try to discover how it appears to our mind. Eventually, we shall see that although in this case there is not such an inflated sense of I, nevertheless the I still appears to be inherently existent, existing from its own side, without depending upon the body or the mind. Once we have an image of the inherently existent I, we focus on it for a while with single-pointed concentration, and then we proceed to the second stage. Refuting the object of negation. If the I exists in the way that it appears, it must exist in one of four ways: as the body, as the mind, as the collection of the body and mind, or as something separate from the body and mind. There is no other possibility. We contemplate this carefully until we become convinced that this is the case, and then we proceed to examine each of the four possibilities. 1. If the I is the body, there is no sense in saying, "my body," because the possessor and the possessed are identical. If the I is the body, there is no rebirth, because the I ceases when the body dies. If the I and the body are identical, then since we are capable of developing faith, dreaming, solving mathematical puzzles and so on, it follows that flesh, blood and bones can do the same. Since none of this is true, it follows that the I is not the body. 2. If the I is the mind, there is no sense in saying, "my mind," because the possessor and the possessed are identical. But usually when we focus on our mind, we say, "my mind." This clearly indicates that the I is not the mind. If the I is the mind, then since each person has many types of mind, such as the six consciousnesses, conceptual minds, and non-conceptual minds, it follows that each person has just as many eyes. Since this is absurd, it follows that the I is not the mind. 3. Since the body is not the I, and the mind is not the I, the collection of the body and mind cannot be the I. The collection of the body and mind is a collection of things that are not the I, so how can the collection itself be the I? For example, in a herd of cows, none of the animals is a sheep, therefore the herd itself is not sheep. In the same way, in the collection of the body and mind, neither the body nor the mind is the I, therefore the collection itself is not the I. You may find this point difficult to understand, but if you think about it for a long time with a calm and positive mind, and discuss it with more experienced practitioners, it will gradually become clear to you. You can also consult authentic books on the subject, such as Heart of Wisdom. 4. If the I is not the body, not the mind, and not the collection of the body and mind, the only possibility that remains is that it is something separate from the body and mind. If this is the case, we must be able to apprehend the I without either the body or the mind appearing. But if we imagine that our body and our mind were completely to disappear, there will be nothing remaining that could be called the I. Therefore, it follows that the I is not separate from the body and mind. We should imagine that our body gradually dissolves into thin air, and then our mind dissolves, our thoughts scatter with the wind, our feelings, wishes, and awareness melt into nothingness. Is there anything left that is the I? There is nothing. Clearly, the I is not something separate from the body and mind. We have now examined all four possibilities and have failed to find the I. Since we have already decided that there is no fifth possibility, we must conclude that the truly existent or inherently existent I that normally appears so vividly does not exist at all. Where there previously appeared an inherently existent I, there now appears an absence of that I. This absence of an inherently existent I is emptiness, ultimate truth. We contemplate in this way until there appears to our mind a generic image of the absence of an inherently existent I. This image is our object of placement meditation. We try to become completely familiar with it by concentrating on it single-pointedly for as long as possible. Because we have grasped at an inherently existent I since beginningless time, and have cherished it more dearly than anything else, the experience of failing to find the I in meditation can be quite shocking at first. Some people develop fear, thinking that they have become completely non-existent. Others feel great joy, as if the source of all their problems is vanishing. Both reactions are good signs and indicate correct meditation. After a while, these initial reactions will subside, and our mind will settle into a more balanced state. Then, we shall be able to meditate on emptiness in a calm, controlled manner. We should allow our mind to become absorbed in space-like emptiness for as long as possible. It is important to remember that our object is emptiness, the absence of an inherently existent I, not mere nothingness. Occasionally, we should check our meditation with alertness. If our mind has wandered to another object, or if we have lost the meaning of emptiness and are focusing on mere nothingness, we should return to the contemplations to bring emptiness clearly to mind once again. We may wonder, if there is no truly existent I, then who is meditating? Who will get up from meditation, speak to others, and reply when my name is called? Though there is nothing within the body and mind, or separate from the body and mind, that is the I, this does not mean that the I does not exist at all. Although the I does not exist in any of the four ways just mentioned, it does exist conventionally. The I is merely a designation imputed by the conceptual mind upon the collection of the body and mind. So long as we are satisfied with the mere designation I, there is no problem. We can think, I exist, I am going to town, and so on. The problem arises only when we look for an I other than the mere conceptual imputation I. The self-grasping mind grasps at an I that ultimately exists, independent of conceptual imputation, as if there were a real I existing behind the label. If such an I existed, we would be able to find it. But we have seen that the I cannot be found upon investigation. The conclusion of our search was a definite non-finding of the I. This unfindability of the I is the emptiness of the I, the ultimate nature of the I. The I that exists as mere imputation is the conventional nature of the I.